Good morning, everyone, and welcome to ULT in Philadelphia.
Good morning.
If this is our first visit, double welcome.
Thank you.
And we beg you to listen carefully to what we call the Declaration of the Lodge and its policy. And please note, the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too lofty and too absorbing to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification in practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching. Therefore, has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers. The sole bond between its associates being that basis, and it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and do desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. We ask you, if this is your first visit, to stop at the desk or as you come in the door and pick up this wonderful little pamphlet. You can't miss it, it's beautiful color. And as stated, on the front of this declaration is what we just heard. Now we hold each week two meetings. Today, as you realize, we began at 11 o'clock, but the door is open at 10:30, so you can come in and be familiar. February the 23rd. The topic today is Dr. Albert Schweitzer, whom everybody has at least heard of. Now, the doors open at 10:30. We begin at 11 and we'll be done by 12. That's on Sunday. Wednesday, we have a study class. The doors open at 5:15, allowing you to come in and visit our library and book table. It's wonderful. There you may spend time with the librarian or the book table usher, checking out this little pamphlet or any other question you might want to have. Everybody's welcome to use that library and study by it. Now, to make it short, today being February the 23rd, the topic will be Dr. Albert Schweitzer. But please, before we begin, We would like to read to you a few verses from this wonderful little book called The Voice of the Silence. Very poetic terminology. The Voice of the Silence. This you will find in the library and also at the book table. Now, let's see. Begins with these words. Act. Act thou for them today, and they will act for thee tomorrow. 'Tis from the bud of renunciation of the self that springeth the sweet fruit of final liberation. To perish doomed is he who out of fear of Mara refrains from helping man, lest he should act for self. The pilgrim who would cool his weary limbs in running waters yet dares not plunge, for terror of the stream, risks to succumb from heat. Inaction based on selfish fear can bear but evil fruit. The selfish devotee lives to no purpose. The man who does not go through his appointed work in life has lived in vain. Follow the wheel of life. Follow the wheel of duty to race and kin, to friend and foe, and close thy mind to pleasures as to pain. Exhaust the law of karmic retribution. Gain Siddhis for thy future birth. If sun thou canst not be, then be the humble planet. Aye, if thou art debarred from flaming like the noonday sun upon the snow-capped mount of purity eternal, then choose, O Neophyte, a humbler course. Point out the way. However dimly and lost among the hosts, as does the evening star, to those who tread their path in darkness. Behold, Mi'kmaq, as in his crimson veil, his eye sweeps over slumbering earth. Behold the fiery aura of the hand of Lakhpa, extended in protecting love over the heads of his ascetics. Both are now servants to Enyima, left in his absence, silent watches in the night. Yet both, in Kalpa's past, were bright Enyimas, and may in future days again become two stars, two suns. Such are the falls and rises of the karmic law. There are a few more verses. We beg you to listen. Be, O land new like them. Give light and comfort to the toiling pilgrim, and seek out him who knows still less than thou, who in his wretched desolation sits starving for the bread of wisdom and the bread which feeds the shadow. Without a teacher, hope or consolation, and let him hear the law. Thank you very much.
Friends, this month our umbrella theme has been Nobel and Noble Theosophical Voices. The personages that we have highlighted this month all have been recipients of the Nobel Peace Prize, and Alfred Nobel, in his will, said that the Nobel Peace Prize belongs to the person who shall have done the most or best work for fraternity between nations, for the abolition or reduction of standing armies, and for the holding and promotion of peace conferences. And they are theosophical voices because, as Mr. Judge has written, wherever thought has struggled to be free, there is some aspect of the theosophical movement. For our generation, the individuals we've taken up, Mother Teresa, the 14th Dalai Lama, Martin Luther King Jr., these are household names, and the very mention conjures up feelings and inspirations of service and gratitude and determination to help humanity. And yet, before there was the example of Mother Teresa sacrificing, renouncing her status to work for the disadvantaged poor in India, there was Albert Schweitzer. Before there was the Dalai Lama spreading throughout the world his message of kindness and compassion, there was Albert Schweitzer. And before there was the Dalai Lama and Martin Luther King, before there was Martin Luther King's dream of peace and brotherhood of humanity, there was Albert Schweitzer. And yet, for many in our generation today, except for some notable exceptions we'll mention later, his memory, his significance is fading or has faded. For some, mention his name and maybe, oh yeah, he was some famous doctor. Winston Churchill called Albert Schweitzer the genius of humanity. JFK called him the transcendental moral influence of our century. And even the Dalai Lama said that his conduct, his philosophy, and his life and campaign against nuclear weapons remain great sources of inspiration today. So if you grew up and lived through the first half of the 20th century, especially after the horrors of World War II, your moral hero, your inspiration to be a better human being, to do more for humanity, was Albert Schweitzer. He devoted his equally brilliant intellect, creative genius, and compassion to practically work for the true service of humanity. There is perhaps no better introduction to Albert Schweitzer than these words from President Jimmy Carter. Albert Schweitzer brought to the early 20th century one of the most powerful and wide-ranging intellects the world has seen. He not only studied but also mastered philosophy, music, theology, and medicine. He even became the world's authority on Bach and organ building. Then Dr. Schweitzer demonstrated his gratitude for the gifts he had been given by devoting the majority of his life in relieving the suffering of the people of Central Africa. Despite an isolation that is hard to fathom in our age of easy communications, while in Africa, Dr. Schweitzer stayed current on the affairs of the world and provided commentary on ethics, war, nuclear weapons, and environmental degradation. His eclectic interests benefited not only Africa, but the entire world. At the height of his popularity in 1955, a Gallup poll placed him as the fourth most admired man in the world. His radio broadcast reached 50 million people in 50 countries, perhaps the equivalent of a media empire today. So influential and widespread was his word. The Nobel Prize was awarded to Dr. Schweitzer in 1952 for his work in Africa and his efforts to warn the world about the dangers of nuclear tests and their radioactive fallout and nuclear weapons. The Nobel Institute issued this statement on the Nobel Prize winner. The expression "reverence for life" is key to Albert Schweitzer's personal philosophy. No person must ever harm or destroy life unless absolutely necessary. This attitude permeated everything he did. As a sidebar, we might mention that he was awarded in 1952. He didn't actually accept it until 1953. One of the reasons was he was too busy in Africa helping the poor and suffering there. And also, even when he did accept it, he was not too happy with the fact that he had to travel there first class. He felt it was a waste of money. He complained about having running water in his hotel room. What am I, a trout, that I need running water? He was very upset that they brought fresh flowers to his room because he was very unhappy to see flowers wilt around him. And when he did give his speech, as was the practice of the day, you spoke in front of a microphone to an invisible audience, which was broadcast, and he refused to do that. He would only speak into a microphone if there was a people there that he could speak directly to and personally, just to give you a flavor of the nature of the individual who was being honored. Albert Schweitzer spoke on the radio to people all over the world. He corresponded with the great statesmen, east and west of the time. His words inspired and touched the mind and heart of an entire generation. So we will allow him to speak directly to us in order to realize that his was a noble and noble theosophical voice. We will begin with an excerpt from his Nobel Prize acceptance speech he called "The Problem of Peace." Is the spirit capable of achieving what we in our distress must expect of it? The spirit created this humanitarianism, which is the origin of all progress towards some form of higher existence. Inspired by humanitarianism, we are true to ourselves and capable of creating. Inspired by the contrary spirit, we are unfaithful to ourselves and fall prey to all manner of error. This spirit is convinced that compassion, in which ethics takes root, does not assume its true proportion until embraces not only man, but every living being. Once more, we dare to appeal to the whole man, to his capacity to think and feel, exhorting him to know himself and to be true to himself. We reaffirm our trust in the profound qualities of his nature. I am well aware that what I have had to say on the problem of peace is not essentially new. The only originality I claim is that for me this truth goes hand in hand with the intellectual certainty that the human spirit is capable of creating in our time a new mentality, an ethical mentality. Inspired by this certainty, I too proclaim this truth in the hope that my testimony may help prevent its rejection as an admirable sentiment, but a practical impossibility. Many a truth has lain unnoticed for a long time, ignored simply because no one perceived its potential for becoming reality. Only when an ideal of peace is born in the minds of people will the institutions set up to maintain this peace effectively fulfill the function expected of them. If these words and convictions sound theosophical, it is no accident. Albert Schweitzer had made direct contact with the theosophical movement. Early in his life, he was personally acquainted with Annie Besant, a prominent member of the Theosophical Society, especially in India. In 1902, when he was 27 years old, she asked him to attend the Theosophical Conference in Strasbourg for two reasons. One is that Rudolf Steiner, who was then a very prominent intellectual and member of the Theosophical Society in Europe, was going to be there, and she wanted him to talk with Schweitzer, and for them both to become friends. But there was another reason. He spoke fluent German and French. So his role at the meeting, besides just attending, was to be the official translator. Now, let's put that in context. This is a conference, talks on theosophy, which he's hearing for the first time. He doesn't really have any time to daydream, but he has to focus on everything that's said, take the words expressed in one language, digest them, and quickly express them in another language to people who may or may not have heard this. Just think of that capacity brought. So he wrote a letter about his friendship with Rudolf Steiner through the years, and he said that he discovered at this conference and in spending the time with Steiner, that he shared with Steiner and the other members of the Theosophical Society the possibility of finding spiritual truths. He found that he shared with them a life mission and goal of working for the emergence of a culture inspired by the ideal of humanity and encourage people to become truly thinking beings. His path, he said, was to help it arise by concentrating on the ethics of the reference for life. Now, he had studied theology and became a cleric. He had already earned doctorates in wide recognition in theology, philosophy, and music at this time. This was not enough for him. He wanted to do something more practical. He renounced all this and decided to help and heal the people living in a remote region of French Equatorial Africa. Now, we want to put this in a little bit of context for you. So, at the age of 30, he entered medical school and 12 years later became a physician. He had specialized not just in medicine, but in surgery and tropical medicine. All this time, he's continuing to give organ recitals, form the Paris Bach Society, lecture in philosophy, conduct services as he was a cleric, all while going to medical school, raising money for the hospital he planned to establish once he became a physician. Together with his wife, who was a nurse, he built and ran a hospital at the mission station in Gabon, a French colony at that time. His photograph appears on the cover of Time magazine on July 11, 1947, as the man of the century. When asked in the magazine interview about his philosophy and reverence for life, he simply answered, "I've made my life my argument." He said his philosophy was inspired by the teachings of Jesus and his experiences in Africa. However, he came into life already with a conviction of this truth. He was born on January 14, 1875, in the village of Kaisersberg, France, on the border with Germany, into a family of pastors, teachers, and musicians. His father, Louis, was a Protestant minister. His mother, Adele, was the daughter of a pastor. Yet at the age of 5, he already showed evidence of having a mind of his own. He later wrote, quote, "Already before I started school, it seemed quite incomprehensible to me that my evening prayers were supposed to be limited to human beings. Therefore, when my mother had prayed with me and kissed me goodnight, I secretly added another prayer which I had made up myself for all living beings. It went like this: Dear God, protect and bless all beings that breathe, keep all evil from them, and let them sleep in peace." His ability to think and reason for himself and question religious dogmas was evident at an early age. He wrote, now think of this from an 8-year-old. He wrote, "When I was 8 years old, my father gave me, at my request, a New Testament, which I read eagerly. One of the stories that occupied my mind most was that of the wise men from the East. What did Jesus' parents do with the gold and precious things they received from these men? I wondered how they could have later become poor again. It was completely incomprehensible to me that the wise men from the East never bothered about the Christ child later on at all." He was haunted by these and other inconsistencies in the New Testament. His later theological works did not conform to the commonly held views of Christianity. He didn't mind being an original and controversial theologian. He was more concerned with truth than with the approval of his fellow scholars and theologians. Now, his work, The Quest for the Historical Jesus, he wrote and published when he was 26 years old. It is still a primary text in Catholic Christian seminaries around the world today. It is considered by many to be one of the most influential works of the 20th century and the most influential work on Christianity in modern times, as it forms the basis of the modern view of the historical basis of Jesus and his relevance in modern times. What did he mean? What did he teach about that? Well, we'll read his words, but basically he was saying that the life of Jesus as we have it is not only inconsistent, but it's irrelevant to our times. It meant something at that time, but it's his message, it's his spirit, which arises in all, which has the relevance today. He wrote, "The abiding and eternal in Jesus is absolutely independent of his historical knowledge and can only be understood by contact with his spirit. But the truth is, it is not Jesus as historically known, but Jesus as spiritually arisen in men who is significant for our time and can help it." In other words, he held to the Gnostic idea that the Christ principle is the higher self within each, and it can be felt and inspire all, just as in the voice of the silence we have the expression, "Look within, thou art Buddha." Having already earned his first doctorate in philosophy at the University of Strasbourg and a reputation as a philosopher who criticized philosophy that withdrew itself from the practical affairs of life or was divorced from any ethical relevance, his celebrity as a philosopher initially grew out of his fearless and analytical critique of the works of such intellectual giants as Kant and Nietzsche. He went on to earn his second doctorate in theology and was a practicing cleric by the age of 28. His theological scholarship and persuasive arguments that the history of Jesus as presented in the New Testament was inconsistent and inaccurate because it was a later construction of the church, that the account of Jesus was not relevant to modern times, earned him worldwide recognition as an original, if not only a controversial theologian. He was an accomplished musician and organ player who gave concerts all over Europe. He had written a major work on the interpretation of Bach and was considered one of the world authorities on the subject at the time. He wrote and demonstrated that Bach's musical design, its harmonies, motifs, and rhythms were meant to illustrate symbolically the actual meaning of the words of the hymns on which the hymns, the musical works were based. His performances on the organ emphasized clarity of expression, using refined instruments suitable to Baroque music rather than the romantic preferences of the time. His work to rescue, restore, and build such instruments, his work on organ building laid the foundation for modern day instruments. This was all before the age of 30. Then in 1904, he read about the injustices and cruelties that the Africans were suffering at the hands of Europeans and the tremendous suffering of the people there from infectious diseases. This was a magazine published by the Paris Missionary Society. He decided to become a medical doctor. Now, the problem is there initially was that in order to go to Africa as a missionary and help, you had to be sponsored and approved by the Paris Missionary Society, which was a Protestant organization. So when he had already decided he wanted to be a doctor, and he was already well known, they rejected him. They did not want to go. They thought he was too dangerous. They were concerned that he might preach and spread his own views about Christianity and Jesus to the Africans. And he said, no, I am not going to do that. I'm just going as a doctor to help the suffering. And they made him promise that he would only practice medicine there, but would not preach to them his own views. That's how influential he was. So he went to Africa, built a large hospital and leper colony in Africa. He practiced in an area rife with malaria, dysentery, sleeping sickness, which is a parasitic illness transmitted by the bite of the tsetse fly, elephantiasis, and leprosy. His treatment was always free. Nobody paid. Everything there, with all the hospitals, the medicines, the services were provided by the money that he raised as being a writer, performer. Even the $33,000 he received as recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize went to those hospitals. When asked why he wanted to become a doctor, he said, "It struck me as inconceivable that I should be allowed to lead such a happy life while I saw so many people around me struggling with sorrow and suffering. Until I was 30, I could consider myself justified in devoting myself to scholarship and the arts. But that, after that, I would devote myself directly to serving humanity. I had tried many times to find the meaning that lay hidden in the sayings of Jesus, 'Whosoever would save his life shall lose it.' There are no heroes of action, only heroes of renunciation and suffering." Albert Schweitzer died in September 1965 at the age of 90 from a stroke and exhaustion from the work he kept up for 50 years. One week before his death, he wrote about his search for the meaning of life, which resolved itself in a flash of insight. "It was the dry season in unusually wet equatorial Africa, and we crept upstream. laboriously feeling for the channels between the sandbanks of the Ugun River. Lost in thought, I sat on the deck of the barge, struggling to find the elementary and universal conception of ethics. Sheet after sheet I covered with disconnected sentences, merely to keep myself concentrated on the problem. Late on the third day, at the very moment when at sunset we were making our way through a herd of hippopotamuses, there flashed upon my mind, unforeseen and unsought, quote, reverence for life. The iron door had yielded. The path in the thicket had become visible. Now I had found my way to the idea in which life, affirmation, and ethics are contained side by side. Thus, to me, ethics is nothing else than reverence for life. Reverence of life affords me my fundamental principle of morality, namely that good consists in maintaining, assisting, and enhancing life, and to destroy, to harm, or to hinder life is evil. Regarding this philosophy of the reverence of life, he wrote, "The truth of philosophy is validated by our experience of the relationship between our being and that of the universe. The more we look into nature, the more we realize that it is full of life and that we are united with all life that is in nature. Man can no longer live for himself alone. We are united to all. This life and all life is valuable and deserves reverence. From this knowledge comes our spiritual relationship to the universe. By means of reverence for life, we establish a spiritual and humane relationship with both people and all living creatures within our reach. The ethic of reverence of life constrains all, in whatever walk of life they may find themselves, to busy themselves intimately with all the human and vital processes which are being played out around them, and give themselves as men to the man who needs human help and sympathy. It demands from all that they should sacrifice a portion of their own lives for others. In what way, in what means, are this his duty? This everyone must decide on the basis of thoughts which rise in himself and the circumstances which attend the course of his own life. The self-sacrifice of one may not be particularly in evidence. He carries it out simply by continuing his normal life. Another is called to some striking surrender, which obliges him to set on one side all regards for his own progress. Let no one measure himself by his conclusions regarding someone else. The destiny of man has to fulfill itself in a thousand ways so that goodness may be actualized. What every individual has to contribute remains his own secret, but we all must mutually share in the knowledge that our existence only attains its true value when we have experienced in ourselves the truth of the declaration, he who loses his life shall find it." Now, we started out by saying that the memory of Albert Schweitzer is fading. But that is not true if you are an active member of Doctors Without Borders, who consider him the first Doctor Without Borders. If you're an active member of the Peace Corps formed by John F. Kennedy, because you know that you probably, if you joined up at that time, the first places you want were the hospitals and institutions established by Albert Schweitzer. And many of the Peace Corps members today do their training and education in facilities and institutions either directly formed or inspired or dedicated to his work. If you're an active member of the Greenpeace, you look at Albert Schweitzer as the first activist who spoke out in defense of the environment, who was opposed to nuclear war not only because of its potential danger of humanity, but even the fallout from nuclear radiation was a harm to all of life. And he tried desperately in his writing to Khrushchev and JFK to convince them to disarm. If you're an animal rights activist, you probably have been sponsored, awarded, or looked to Albert Schweitzer as the first individual who spoke out and vehemently opposed cruelty to animals and all forms of life. If you're part of the anti-nuclear movement and have demonstrated, you know that Albert Schweitzer, just the thoughts, the mention of his name, that he was going to speak, draw out hundreds of thousands to protest in the 50s against nuclear war, and today is still looked to as an inspiration. And if you are a member and active in the civil rights movement, whether it's in South Africa or America, you know that it is Albert Schweitzer who, in the earlier part of the century, was the prime example of how individuals could step out and treat their fellow human beings with reverence and respect and do something practically to work for their freedom and work for their disappearance of their suffering. So we don't think there is enough time in a half hour or even several days to encompass his work. But we have tried to at least present the example of a human being who, by his own thoughts and words and deeds, tried to inspire others to do within their own life to be a better human being, a more responsible human being, a more thinking human being, and do what they could in their own sphere to make it a better world, not just for other human beings, but for all that lives. Now, we're sure you may have some thoughts or questions on this subject. Yes?
We wonder if someone else who is more or less lost to history, being that Dr. Benjamin Rush of Philadelphia, one of the signers of the Declaration of Independence, and with Benjamin Franklin founded the first hospital in the United States, Pennsylvania Hospital. But he also passed the first legislation preventing cruelty to animals. And also he was the first doctor to establish humane treatment for the mentally ill. Mm-hmm. And so he had an amazing life.
Yes.
And he was, we would say, a theosophist as well.
Yes. We say that regardless of one's race, creed, sex, condition, organization, whoever is inspired from within through a realization of the oneness of life, through the real their nature of all human beings, the reverence, the unity of all of life, to work for the true service of humanity, to lift it up physically, mentally, morally, spiritually, in whatever way they can, is a theosophist. One who knows in their own way and practices their own way divine intuitive wisdom, divine wisdom, spiritual knowledge. Yes?
Well, when we look at the idea of genius and we take into consideration these four personages that we've been studying this month, when you combine that with the idea of karma and everything that they were able to bring forward, I mean, it's just really incredible what these people were able to do in one short life. But they were able to do it because of what they brought with them. Mm-hmm. From previous lives, with the motivation, the intellect, and all.
Yes. So with the case of Albert Schweitzer, the subtitle for the talk is polymath. Now, we don't think that's a term that does justice to him. We like the term Winston Churchill used, a genius of humanity. But we know a generalist is someone who knows a little bit about a lot of things. But a polymath is one who excels in knowledge in a number of areas and can bring all that knowledge in a creative, inventive way to the solution of a problem. And so we have that example with Albert Schweitzer. But unlike other polymaths who just may have expressed it intellectually and creatively, he also brought that moral, ethical, compassionate element too. And his influence probably is most recognized for his genius and expression and the way he conducted his life throughout his life, and the inspiration his ideas continue to have their effect. He was also a student of Eastern religions, and he studied much of Hinduism and Buddhism. We have quotation sheets out there for you, just to give you a smattering of some of his thoughts on the mind, the power of thought, ethics, and so forth. But we thought there were two. He was a student of the Bhagavad Gita, and he says, "The Bhagavad Gita has a profound influence on the spirit of mankind by its devotion to God, which is manifested by actions." Actions in the service of that which is all of life, the source of all. He also said this of reincarnation. Reincarnation contains a most comforting explanation of reality, by means of which Indian thought surmounts difficulties which baffle the thinkers of Europe. So he was well aware of the world of thought, but also creative in his own way. Yes?
Well, we mentioned four great minds or great beings of the that we know of the century, but we have others that we haven't mentioned.
Sure.
Nelson Mandela, Vaclav Havel, Mahatma Gandhi. I'm sure we can go on.
Yes.
Maybe others have other names of other great beings that have contributed.
So in preparation for this talk, we did some search on the connection between those individuals and Albert Schweitzer. Of course, he reached his height of popularity and influence before them. But in every case, when you look at one, their names are mentioned in concert with the others. The Dalai Lama gives praise to Albert Schweitzer, and he is himself, beside receiving the Peace Prize, the Dalai Lama also received the Albert Schweitzer Humanitarian Award. Desmond Tutu, Vaclav Havel, Nelson Mandela, all these individuals are connected by individuals within those organizations who perform the work of those individuals, recognize the contribution of Albert Schweitzer. We need to remember that he not only worked to relieve the physical suffering, but he spoke out and was an active critic and of the colonialism and the mistreatment of the Africans there. The way not only the physical suffering and torture they went through, but also things that were going on that were repressing their development and growth. And we need to remember that he spoke. He not only had the power of the example of his life, but an eloquence of expression where he could get on the radio and reach 50 million people at one time and inspire them to act, to take heed and do something about it. So, yes, there are many voices, and we are, we tend to look at the 20th century, and rightly so, as sometimes an age of horrors, and sometime in our own age, we are, our own century, we are overwhelmed with the suffering and the misery, but it's good for us to take a moment to acknowledge that people of all backgrounds and races have found within themselves the same inspiration, within their own traditions and religious experiences, the same inspiration, the same basic fundamental truths and laws that we put out in Theosophy. Adding to it that these are timeless truths. We can find them in ancient and modern times, Eastern and Western, and there have been many theosophical, quote, voices throughout the ages, and we still have them in our time. We want to mention that without Albert Schweitzer, he was not just interested in the ethical, the moral action of an individual to take responsibility for his own life, to be a better human being, to find some way he could help. But he also, as we said, emphasized the importance of us being thinking human beings, of using our power of thought. And we have a few quotes on that we've given out to you. Renunciation of thinking is a declaration of spiritual bankruptcy. Recognizing there that the power to think is a spiritual power. And when we don't think for ourselves, try to be attentive to the ideas we hold, to check, test, and verify, we are, and give it up to outside authorities or to popular opinion, give it up in the search for truth, it's basically our own declaration of spiritual bankruptcy. At the same time, he goes on to say, thought, now we said so far how much he emphasized getting out there and practically doing something to help, but he didn't stop there. He said, thought is the strongest thing we have. Work done by true and profound thought, that is a real force. Once again, drawing the attention to the inner, the complete nature of the human being, spiritual power of thought, how it can be abandoned or used with great effect in the world we live. And there are many quotes we could give on how this can apply in one's individual life, but also in whatever area of human endeavor. Yes?
Well, one of the concepts that we find in theosophical writings is that we endeavor to promote the idea of self-reliance, that is the basis of really an education. What is meant by self-reliance?
What is meant by self-reliance? Well, self-reliance doesn't just mean to rely on ourselves as we see ourselves as separate individual personal human beings, to take inventory of our strengths and weaknesses and use our strengths and rely on them to do more things for ourselves, to not be so dependent. Self-reliance also goes back to that recognition of and a greater appreciation of what is the true self, the true nature of the self in each and all. And just as Albert Schweitzer point to the fact that the real significance of a being such as Buddha or Jesus is the way that arises within the human being. That's pointing to the realization that our self in its true nature is divine, is one and inseparable with the deity in nature or beyond nature. It is a divine spark. And self-reliance is that there is falling back and identifying with that and acting from that basis in whatever we do. Yes?
Could we hear again those few phrases at the front of the declaration upon independent devotion? Well,
the policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy, without professing attachment to theosophical organization. And it's interesting, as we read that, we were reminded of Dr. Schweitzer's words that the way one chooses to serve, the way one chooses to renounce oneself, to give a part of oneself to the service of others, that's their own business. That's secret. You don't have to compare yourself with another's life. Under one circumstance, one might have to put aside a lot of things in order to do that. Under another circumstance, it might be just living your ordinary life. He was a family man. He was married. He had a daughter. He had a career. He was a world figure. And yet, even in the simplest things, he didn't try to tell people to be like them. As a matter of fact, one of his more famous quotes was, "Each one of you can find your own Gaborene." Now, Gaborene was the name of the hospital that he set up in Africa. But each one of you can find and build your own Gaborene. In other words, self-induced, self-devised effort, individual devotion to the cause of theosophy, which is the cause of the elevation of humanity, spiritually, mentally, morally, and physically.
We were wondering if that other famous Albert Einstein, and their lives were very closely aligned and their careers as being contemporaries, did they have a relationship or correspondence?
They certainly did. After the first atomic bomb were set off, not in war, but continuous atomic setting, it was three Nobel Prize winners who joined together in their efforts to actively demonstrate and speak out against the horrors, dangers, and proliferation of nuclear weapons and testing. One of them was Albert Schweitzer, the other one was Albert Einstein, and the third was Linus Pauling. These three worked together on that, but Albert Einstein and Albert Schweitzer were in close communication throughout their lives. We wanted to finish our meeting with this statement from Albert Schweitzer to carry with you, and to get an understanding that when he says reverence of life, he doesn't mean just the form. He's talking to the realization that everything is alive and conscious and has a will to exist. And living in that ocean of life, as he put it, we realize that we are part of it and we should work in harmony with all that lives. So I'll leave you with these words. A man is really ethical only when he obeys the constraint laid on him to help all which he is able to succor. And when he goes out on his way to avoid injuring anything living, he does not ask how far this or that life deserves sympathy as valuable in itself, nor how far it is capable of feeling. To him, life as such is sacred. He He shatters no ice crystal that sparkles in the sun, tears no leaf from its tree, breaks off no flower, and is careful not to crush any insect as he walks. If he works by lamplight on a summer evening, he prefers to keep the windows shut, to breathe stifling air, rather than to see insect after insect fall on his table with singed and sinking wings. Our meeting is adjourned.